Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit by Louisville Public Media.
Welcome back to listeners. Election season's over and done. Yay. I'm excited about that. It is over. Finito. At least until this time next year. Well, actually, probably just for a few more months. And then folks will be gearing up for next year's primaries and general elections or whatever. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So, listeners, November is National Adoption Awareness Month. And so I figured, what better topic to do, Doc, than to talk about all issues adoption.
Yes.
And in particular, I was interested, like, okay, I was looking for a guest, like, so I put out a call on social media, like, we need a guest to talk about adoption, but let's make it kind of interesting, right? So not just regular on adoption, if there's such a thing, but I was like, is there anybody out there that has a very interesting adoption story? Perhaps you were adopted transracially, you know, by parents of a different race than yourself, or maybe you were adopted by LGBT parents, or maybe you're LGBT and they're not. And I think we hit the jackpot because I got a response for a person who apparently fit all those boxes.
Yay!
So, listeners, I want you all to welcome to the show today our very, very special guest to talk about all things adoption, Morgan Rumpel. Morgan, how are you?
I am doing great, thank you.
Yay, so Morgan!
I mentioned that we hit the jackpot, and that is because he's like, hey, Jason, I was adopted transracially, and my parents are LGBTQ, right?
Right.
That's the short version. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and I guess give us the short version of that story. How did you end up being adopted? First of all, how do your parents identify racially, and then also in terms of gender or sexual orientation?
Sure. Well, first, I just want to say thank you so much for inviting me to the show, and thank you for covering this topic. National Adoption Month is one that I don't often hear celebrated as much, especially as an adopted person. So when I saw the call come out on social media and I saw all the things that Jason was asking for, I said, well, what better a way for me to finally tell my story? So I'm really glad to be here, and thank you all for covering this topic. So, jump into kind of the question that you were talking about as far as where I identify, my adoption story, some things like that. I was adopted when I was about 2 weeks old. And my mom, you know, every year we love doing this adoption story that, you know, we like to celebrate what the adoption looked like.
Is it like theatrical? Like, do you all act it out as like a play, or do you just tell it to one another?
So kind of how my mom, both my moms do it. They like to say, we're going to tell you the story of your adoption.
I love it.
And so it's just kind of going over it and reminding me of kind of how my adoption came about and how our family was formed. And honestly, I'm really glad that they did that because every year I kind of learn something new. So, I was told that I was adopted when I was about 2 weeks old, and both my moms will say they were sitting at home one day and they got a call from a hospital in Somerset, Kentucky. And my family, they all live in Indiana, and the nurse on the phone called my mom, who was an OBGYN nurse at the time, and said, Barb, we have a brown baby at the hospital. Mm. And that's how she said that they called and said, we have a brown baby at the hospital. And I always think that's funny that, you know, they preface with the description.
Yes.
And my mom said, we immediately got in our car. We asked no questions. We didn't really see, you know, what we needed to do to really prepare for that. Jumped in our car, drove, you know, 107 miles to Somerset, Kentucky, and met you for the first time. And so both of my parents, they said, you know, two white mamas coming in and seeing this brown baby, and we just said we had to do it.
I love it.
So, it's really a beautiful story. And for years, you know, like I said, we've been doing this adoption story for a long time. So for years, I was kind of told that form of the story and that version of the story, and it's cute and beautiful, and it's very true. And then as I got older, I learned a lot more of kind of the underlying things that were going on.
That's a very romantic. That's a Hallmark thing. I'm like, I love that.
Right.
Like,
no, so I love it too. Yeah.
But I wonder. Right. Yeah, so you mentioned as you pull back the layers, right? As one gets older, it's probably able to handle more information. As we become adults, we can probably handle stuff or even see things through a different lens than we once did. Was it all romantic? Were there parts that weren't quite so? I mean, you're talking about, first of all, two lesbian women from Indiana. You're talking about them bringing home a brown baby. I mean, was there legal resistance? Was there social resistance, religious, familial? Talk about the parts that probably weren't so glamorous.
Yeah, sure. So as time went on, I got older, and I started asking a few more questions about kind of what that story looked like. And eventually come to find out that and what I was kind of thinking in my head as far as the struggles that might have happened with both of my moms adopting me, with, you know, we had two lesbian parents, two white lesbian parents. I felt like that was kind of maybe where the issues were socially as far as the acceptance of that adoption. And later, as years went on, and honestly, I kind of find this out about 5 years ago, that when my parents went through the adoption process at the very beginning, they were assigned a social worker in Indiana, and come to find out that the social worker actually gave resistance. And my mom told me in kind of a quote that they didn't really want anyone bringing any brown babies into the state. So that's where I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. There's some of the social resistance. I was kind of expecting that a little bit more with the LGBT aspect.
Yeah, like
of the story.
Resistance would be that right, they were LGBT right. parents.
That was never really a concern. It was the brown baby. So certainly. I found out actually about 5 years ago that after the social worker kind of displayed that to them and said, this is what we don't really want that happening, that my parents actually, my brother lived in Louisville, Kentucky at the time. And so the social worker would come and visit us, and my parents would actually load all of my baby stuff that we lived in Indiana from our house, and we'd bring it to Louisville, Kentucky, and have the social worker come there and make it look like that's where we lived. So, you know, that's where the less romantic part of this comes from, and I'm glad that they kind of waited a little bit later in my life to tell me that, because that's a lot. That's kind of heavy to think that. You were going through that as a child. You didn't really. I never really questioned it when I was little what we were doing. But I found out very, very later that that's the situation that was going on. So, so yeah, that was a little bit of the social resistance that we had. There's a lot more later on in my life that, you know, we'll go into in a bit that of that social resistance. But that was from the very beginning that resistance in Indiana. So.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Morgan, how was it with your peers at school, like growing up, like elementary, high school, talking about your two moms, like meeting friends, making friends. And, you know, when you're kids, you're saying like, hey, this is my mom. This is my dad. I mean, how did that work in terms of what your peers and your friend groups felt about your family? And then also, you know, the transracial thing, like how were the dynamics in terms of in your growing up, how did your parents introduce the idea of race and what race meant, you know?
Yeah. So I'm just so glad that we're able to do this, because it's really reminding me of a lot of stuff that I kind of went through as a child that I haven't honestly, like, wasn't able to address a lot when I was growing up. So, you know, like I said, I didn't really notice anything wrong about the fact that we were kind of leaving our house and going to act like we lived somewhere else for a while. I know that. Wouldn't you think that was different? So when I was about 8 years old, I was approached. I'm the youngest in my family. My parents were both about 44. So this age as well kind of played a role. A lot of my all my siblings are much older than me. So I joke and say that I was my parents' midlife crisis. So I was about 8 years old, and my nieces and nephews are all not that much younger than me for the most part. And one of my nieces came up. She was about 6 at the time. And I'll never forget, we were outside, and she asked me a question that really changed my life. She said, Morgie, why are you a different color than Grahams and Lainey? And that was the first time in my life I had ever noticed.
And this is, you were what age at this time?
I was 8 years
old. Okay, 8 years old, yeah.
This is the first time that I had really ever noticed that I was a different color. And so, kind of to explain a little bit of that, I went to an all-white school. There were maybe one or two other people of color in the school, but it wasn't a thing that we were kind of like integrated with each other, and we were not really noticing each other. And I know that kind of might sound a little crazy, but it was never questioned.
It's inconsequential.
To me.
Like, we just,
it was never questioned to me. And so, and at that moment, I realized a few things. One, I didn't really notice that I was a different color than the rest of my family. And also at that moment, I realized, I think maybe I come home to a family that might be different than other people's families. And that was, I lived with two moms. A lot of people that we associated with throughout our lives, I had a lot of aunts growing up who were also within the LGBT community in Louisville. And I still have a lot of aunts. And honestly, I never knew that other people were going home and that their families were that different than mine. In a way, it was a good thing. It was a blessing. But also, in a way, now that I look back at it, there was some damaging factors to that I wasn't made fully aware of surroundings. And so that, honestly, that was the first time in my life that I did realize color. And looking back on it again, I that's a kind of a sad thing for me in some ways. My parents will often, and still to this day, will apologize to me. Often will say things like, "We're really sorry that we were not able to."
Are they apologizing for not addressing it? Like, so they're not apologizing for adopting a brown baby, but they're apologizing because that's the question. So then your cousin says, or your niece or nephew says, like, why are you a different color than our grandparents? And so what is your immediate next step? Do you say, like, what are you talking about? Do you run to your parents and say, ask them a question, and they give you the brush off? How does the racial discussion manifest? Do you ever ask them, or do you kind of keep it internal? When you ask them, do they brush it off, or whatever kind of happens next?
Yeah, so kind of after that happened, I realized, looking back on it, I internalized a lot of things.
Okay.
I didn't feel there was a lot of people that I could go out and talk to about it, because in that moment, I realized I was different.
Especially 8 years old, you don't know how to necessarily ask that question to your parents.
I realized I was different. And like at 8 years old, that's a lot sometimes to take on. Okay, I'm different. How do I address this? So that was one aspect of it. And I remember I didn't really have a lot of conversations with my parents about that. Honestly, at that moment, and within my family, there was a lot more discussion and how are we going to address the LGBT part of this? So then I realized I have two moms.
Yeah.
And when I look back on my life, honestly, probably from the time that I was in elementary school, first grade, up until I got to 11th grade, because I remember the day it happened, until I got to 11th grade in high school, I didn't let anyone know. That I had. And I also
had
two moms.
Okay.
And one thing that around that really impacted my life is that when I was about 12 years old, I remember one of my moms coming to me, because I think she knew that I was struggling with that.
Okay.
And I remember her coming to me, we're in the driveway, and she said, "If it's easier for you, you can tell people at school that I'm your aunt."
Yes, I was going to ask. So then you had to pick a primary mother. Like, this parent would be the one that would go to the conferences, and the other one would just kind of be like the peripheral. So that's how you navigated that. She said, "I can be the aunt." Wow.
Yeah, because I was wondering what would happen, like at sleepovers or people coming to your house, like peers coming to visit your home or anything like that, if they were asking, like, what is the dynamic happening and stuff.
It was honestly very much a struggle for me growing up. I really had to hide.
Yeah.
I felt like I was hiding two of my identities. You know, I was not really able to be open. I know openly black is not, but I wasn't able to express that very well. Mm. And then on top of that, I had two moms that, you know, one I have to call my aunt. And so that's kind of how we ended up handling sleepovers and things like that. And both of my moms had work schedules that were very different. So we were sometimes able to avoid it. But then you have things like school activities.
Yeah.
You have things like, I was in band. And so both moms, you know, both of my moms would come, but I wasn't able to address both of them as my parents.
Wow.
And so
did that affect your, like, the mom that had to be the aunt? Did that affect things in a negative way, or did you all kind of understand, like, this is what we have to do to survive, and it never, in other words, are you closer to the one that was allowed to be mom? Are you perhaps closer to the one that wasn't allowed to be mom, or how did that work? Are you all?
Yeah. So that's a great question. You know, both of my moms, one I called mom and one I called Lainey.
Okay.
And so that was already like a distinction that was being made within the family, and who got what title and who got almost what privileges as far as being my parent. So we did do that distinguishing factor with the calling of names. Another thing that I remember is that I had a lot of issues around, because my siblings were from one mom. Both of my moms were both previously married and had children. And so I had siblings who were not all related to each other by blood either.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to explain that while you're also going to school with your nieces and nephews who are your siblings' kids. it was all a very, very interesting thing. But one thing I will never forget is that when my mom, when Lainey did come to me and say, you know, you can call me aunt, it wasn't until 11th grade that I actually started telling people I had two moms. And for some people, it wasn't surprising. But for others, it was, they were taken back. And also going on in this time period was the election of Obama. And so there was a lot of stuff going around with a lot of things.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, I was already feeling a little bit vulnerable racially within my school and how to handle that, because I there was a lot of racism going on within the school and in the community. Mm. And then on top of that, I cannot hold in and suffer anymore with having to hide the identity of my family. So, another thing that also happened while I was growing up in my community in Harrison County in Indiana, we held the KKK convention, when I was younger. And so that brought a level of safety concerns to both my family and to myself. And so that was the moment when I was in early teens that we really had a conversation about safety and protecting ourselves and our community. So, a few other things when I was younger that I didn't really realize until I got older. One, you know, I was my parents eventually joined the Presbyterian Church. Mm-hmm. And my parents had me baptized, and I remember the week after my baptism, both of my parents went up with me, and the week after my baptism, about 4 to 5 families left the church.
It was,
by the way, that's supposed to be a liberal Presbyterian, like in terms of religious.
Really?
That's a more liberal leaning denomination.
Oh, wow.
Than, for example, Southern Baptist, right? Presbyterian Church USA is based here in Louisville, listeners, if you're out of town, and they're considered like the more liberal. Among them are more liberal, right? But they're still like have challenges.
Right.
Huh?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And it was shocking to me to find that out because, like you said, this is supposed to be one of the more supportive communities. Mm. And to know that families left the church because both of my moms went up and supported my baptism.
Wow. I mean, that just seems so challenging. I mean, at least the way you describe adolescence, teenagehood, navigating, you know, having two moms, also navigating, race, mm-hmm. right? Being out in terms of blackness or being able to express that or ask someone about that, right? I mean, some of the controversy around transracial adoption is this idea that white parents are unable to give children of color that they adopt any kind of racial consciousness or discussions about race. I mean, hair becomes a topic for both boys and girls. In terms of your growing up and your experience being a child and now an adult of a transracial adoption, how do you feel about the controversy around and the kind of pushback against letting LGBT couples adopt, you know, children of color? Like, mm-hmm. you know, how do you feel about that? Like, how do you feel about
it? Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I was actually presenting at a international human trafficking conference a few weeks ago in San Diego, and a white woman approached me and asked me that question, which is very unrelated to anything I was talking about.
Yeah.
And I looked at her and I said, "Did I say something about my adoption in the presentation?" She said, "No." And I was like, "Well, the question you're asking me is very relevant to my life." And so it was the first time I'd actually really had a chance to think about it. I'm really glad you asked it. And one thing I was going to say before jumping into that is the hair situation. There was no hiding that, and I am not even embarrassed to say this, there was no hiding that my parents had no idea what to do with my hair.
Oh, no.
No clue. And they know that. So, I'm saying this, and they know that.
Yeah.
But my hair was a mess. And
pictures we can share with our audience? You feel free to send me pictures if you want.
I can. It was so, but I will say it was so bad. My mom, we would spend 8 hours almost every week, one day, and she would braid it all because she didn't want me to be made fun of at school.
Right.
But eventually the school actually ended up banning
braids,
braids and things like that. So,
oh my gosh.
That's a whole nother show.
Okay. That's a whole nother show. Anyway, kind of back to your question with the controversy around adoption and especially interracial adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was approached with that question in San Diego a few weeks ago, I really thought about it for a second because, you know, like I said earlier, my parents still to this day will apologize to me. For not feeling like they adequately involved my culture in my life. When I was growing up, especially younger, and they would apologize for me about these things, I would always say, it's fine. But honestly, the last few years, that question, when it would come up, it impacted me a little bit more. I was realizing I was saying, that's fine. But I also realized I was raised within a white culture to kind of say things are fine sometimes when race is impacting you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taught to be like, it's fine. I'm going to deal with it. So once when this woman approached me and asked this question, I was like, oh, man, I have to be the one to answer this. And so Which is a good thing, but at the same time, I was like, I don't, you know, we're developing a professional relationship right now. You want my personal opinion? So, you know, what I told her was with my upbringing and being raised in a white family, it had its ups and downs. But I think overall, and I know that we kind of talked about being very honest, losing that cultural part of me really impacted me.
Yeah.
I actually would, especially, you know, when I went to college and I started actually being integrated with people of color and actually being able to communicate and talk to people of color, I realized that I had a lot of beliefs and a value system that really didn't reflect me as a person. All right. Protecting myself.
Preaching now. Okay. Yes.
So yeah, no, it's a little deep, you. But yeah. And so I just am saying this very honestly that, yeah, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, if you're a white person and you're saying I want to adopt and I'm adopting cross-culturally or cross-racially, that it's necessarily a negative thing. But what I told this lady who approached me, I said, you're going to have conversations at some point with your child, mm-hmm, and you're going to be wanting to be, you know, you're going to want to say, I'm here for you. I'm, you know, let's talk about race. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. What my concern is that you're going to have all these open conversations with your child about staying safe and about staying proud of who you are, really, honestly. But what if your child comes to you and says, but I don't feel safe in the situation, and then your response is it'll be okay. Then how much actual progress, yeah, did, mm-hmm, you make, and, mm-hmm, and is this actually a beneficial thing to do? So I say all that because in my experience, especially with white parents who are adopting cross-culturally, and in not all cases, but many cases of the folks who I've talked to, they seem to be pretty open and progressive and saying, you know, I know racism is an issue. I know that gender equality is an issue. I know that homophobia is an issue. And that's great that you're talking to these kids about your issues, but you may not be able to truly understand and relate to the, mm-hmm, actual, mm-hmm, issues that your kid's having going to school. Yeah. So, yeah, just those little things when I say, you know, Mom, it's okay that I wasn't really adequately introduced to people that looked like me growing up, but it wasn't really okay.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was kind of something I was taught to just respond with. So all that being said, I don't know if I have a solid answer on pro or against.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that there needs to be a lot more consideration into the impact that you're having on that child.
Certainly some more nuance when it comes to, it's not a hard yes, it's not a hard no. There's a kind of gray area for you in terms of, you know, advocating, yeah, for and purpose. I mean, you want to create a much more complicated relationship because it is, quite frankly, when it comes to ideas of transracial adoption,
right,
wanting to make sure the parents are prepared, certainly wanting the parents to be open from pushback from their kids or, yeah, you know, questions or concerns. I mean, mm-hmm, I think it's an excellent, yeah, answer. And I think it's so accurate and true. I yeah, think that no one should be prevented from adopting and loving and raising a baby and a child that they want, that they're in a financial position to do, but to just be aware that there might
factors,
be some,
yeah,
other factors involved. Very, certainly.
Yeah. Please.
Oh, no, I was just going to say another thing that I shared with her was, you know, a lot of times, especially, and I'm not saying this is true of the whole white community, but when I was growing up, especially when my parents said, you know, we weren't really equipping you with the tool or the knowledge behind your culture and things like that, that even when they were, we were only talking about what they and as my parents or as white parents really thought were the important things to celebrate in the black culture.
And probably what they felt comfortable discussing, like the
right,
parts of blackness,
right,
that are easily consumable by run-of-the-mill white folks, to be frank. I mean, mm-hmm, there are parts of blackness that are really easy, and we could talk about Rosa Parks and Dr. King.
Yeah,
right?
Real palpable,
we can't
yeah,
talk about, you know, other parts that are a bit more,
right,
perhaps more militant or a bit more controversial. So, yeah,
right,
your parents,
right,
they gave you the best. And so I was going to ask you, there are some strategies, AmericanAdoptions.com has some strategies for adoptive families that are transracial. And so they offer, for example, reading books about diversity and race to children, going to social activities where the child can interact with other children of their own race, you know, contacting a mentor who's of the same ethnic background as the child, talking about race openly and honestly, joining a church with a diverse congregation, celebrating traditional holidays. What kind of examples would you offer, perhaps, that can help? Maybe things you wish your parents had done differently? Maybe advice that if you had to give to a transracial family, ways in which parents who might not feel personally equipped to have these discussions, might not have the personal resources, what can they do externally to access those things or to provide those chances for their children?
Sure, sure. So, you know, we definitely were the book, books and yes. songs and movie, you know, we had TV shows. That was all great. That was definitely the way in which my parents handled addressing the cultural, how we're going to help you and teach you about your culture. And so, you know, like I was saying with this lady, those are great. Those are great
that's
things.
One resource.
Yeah, that's one resource, and those are great things to share. But I was not able to, and today, you know, reflecting on today's culture and things like that, I'm still not able fully to be able to process and comprehend and deal with a lot of the issues facing the Black community today. And I feel like that is partially to do with some of my upbringing. So I would say that one thing I really wish that I would have had and would have been introduced to me was people that looked like me.
Yeah.
I just, frankly, I didn't know that there were more than three people in the world that really looked like me. I had the other two folks in my school, but I didn't know about Louisville. I didn't know about that there were really, you know, other people.
Whole neighborhoods of Black people. Like, yeah,
and, right,
like,
right, like, right, right, yeah, right, yeah. right, right. And yeah. But and even so, even when we did go hang out with people of color, yeah. we got in groups of people, and there were folks there that were people of color. We were all still, and I'm trying to figure out the best way of phrasing this, but it was still a certain type of group.
Very similar values, very similar.
Similar yeah, people.
We know what you're saying.
Yeah, like, yeah. People, but I wasn't mean hood people.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't mean hood. Yeah. I didn't exactly. know what the hood was.
A diversity of Black experiences. Absolutely.
I didn't know. I didn't know.
And
so.
I was wondering about that because it seems as if, and I'm glad that there are those, you know, steps that people can take if they're interested in adopting cross-culturally. But again, if we know the way that America's, you know, explicitly set up, white people's lives, everyday American white people, whether they're queer or not, are not set up for diversity. And so they do not have people coming over for dinner. They do not have people coming to their church. They do not have people in their neighborhoods, down the street, up the street. They're not familiar, right, with any people of color for real. I mean, even the most noblest allies, their worlds remain white in a lot of ways. Yeah. And so it would seem very isolating to, even if you have books in your home, even if you're having explicit conversations about race, to be in a community and in a town and in an atmosphere that's all white all the time. I mean, I just, you know, that seems difficult.
Well, I can't help but think of, like, I don't know if you watch the show This Is Us. Do you watch that show?
Yes.
So, you know, and I think about, I'm a couple seasons behind, as Doc always reminds me, but, you know, what I think in particular, I feel like when the show first began to address the racialized issue was when
the grocery store.
Well, there's that with the tongue thing, but no, but he's at the swimming pool, right? And and the Black mom was like, that child got ringworm, and you know the barber taking him to because the mother is either taking him to like a white barber or cutting her hair herself, and he keeps getting as Black boys do as I did when I was a kid, he was getting a ringworm in his head, and the ringworm, listeners, white listeners in particular, is a very harmless like kind of rash. But again, if you go to a barber or quote unquote dirty clippers, Black boys get ringworm, right? And his mother kept thinking, like, you know, why are you scratching? Do you have, like, you know, like the mother couldn't figure out what it was. And the Black mom was like, your child got ringworm. You need to take him to a Black barber. You know what I'm saying? We got this karate class. Come on through. You know what I'm saying? And, so, and the mother and the father, even in their own uncomfortability and with their own reluctance, had to be intentional about, like, yo, we feel like we're giving him a good childhood. Like, these are his siblings. These are his other twins and the triplets. But yeah, but they white, right? And so we have to take him to this karate class in the hood. Yeah, right? We got to take him to a Black barber. We have to be intentional about those kind of things, even when it's uncomfortable. And I think so. I think that's probably what perhaps you wish your parents had done more of putting you in physical places and spaces where you can, because you can learn stuff from reading books all day long, but you got to experience it.
Yeah, and you have to have the interaction, and you have to certainly have those conversations. I mean, you know, instead of. You know, I mean, thank God there's resources now. I remember a couple of, and maybe it was a year ago, I was at the nightclub, at the gay nightclub. My wife's a drag king, so she was performing. And this white woman comes up to me, white lesbian, and says, I think that your hair texture is similar to my child's, what, you know, products do you use and how do you do your hair and all this. It's like, I'm not going to sit when I'm smoking a cigarette at the nightclub and give you a hair tutorial. One, I'm not a hairdresser. I'm a professor. Okay. And if you're interested in knowing how to do your child's hair, you know, there's all sorts of resources like YouTube tutorials. I mean, all sorts of stuff out there. But again, you clearly have a you clearly have a child, right? A child of color. You clearly is a black child, right? And you are coming up to me asking me how to do their hair. Like, that's racist. You see what I'm saying? So that's right. the struggle. That I find with it too. I want kids to grow up in loving and supportive homes, but I do think that, again, conversations about race and introducing introducing kids to a diverse world and helping them to grow into diverse adults is really, really important, you know? And I'm glad that you seem to love your mothers, love your family, but you still are viewing it in your experience with a critical eye that's very necessary for a better world. I mean, truly.
Yeah, I'm like, you know? I'm like, child, I'm in my 30s, early 30s listeners. But, you know, and I'm just now getting a point where I'm real enough with myself to look at parts of my childhood. And again, these things, and so I appreciate that irrespective of, like, adoption or anything, but, like, it takes a lot to be able to look back and say, these are the best parts of my childhood. These are what my parents did really well. Mm-hmm. These are the ways in which they set me up for success. And then these are the ways in which, like, let's keep it real. They kind of fell short. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, like, I think we have to, not just as black people towards white folks, but kids towards parents, be very forgiving, right? Well, you know, at least I wasn't in a crack house. It's like, yeah, but I really wish that you had really, like, done this better, mom or dad. You know, and I think it's okay. And it's therapeutic for us to be able to say, like, yo, these are the ways in which things can be done differently. So I want to see if you all know these things. Okay, well, let's change gears a little bit. Some famous adoptees or adopters or birth parents.
Okay.
So can either of you all just, I mean, is this something that interests you, Morgan, in terms of, I can name 10 people who have been adopted that are celebrities, or I got some people, and I wonder if
okay.
I mean, I definitely have one.
Okay, tell me who you know that's been adopted or has been an adoptee or whatever.
I mean, a famous Angelina Jolie.
Adopted parent.
Yes.
Oh, really?
You know Angelina Jolie? Tell you know that. Her,
I did not.
They got like 10 kids, child.
Oh, no. I thought you meant John Voight is not her dad. I thought
adopted
that she was adopted as a child.
No,
oh, yeah. No, Angelina Jolie,
her.
Yes.
That's her daddy. Can they be falling out? Like, yes. Like, real, yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, okay. Like, yes.
Yes. You know what I'm saying?
But I'm like,
so,
I didn't know she was adopted. Okay. Yes, no.
But yeah,
she is famous, yes.
So was she someone, for example, for you growing up that was a possibility model or someone, a family that you look to? Talk a bit about that.
Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, yeah. I just what that meant to you. Well, because again, some of her kids are black.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? So the way that I was kind of introduced to it, I was listening when I was growing up to some folks in my family talking, and this still I feel like is going on, especially Angelina Jolie and Madonna. There's always this conversation of you know, they're snatching black babies.
Just poaching, going
so
after
that's,
poaching.
That's how I've always heard it. That's how I've always heard it.
I do think Madonna do that, but not Angelina. I love Angelina.
Yeah.
So that's how I've always heard it. And so, honestly, it made me think a little bit about, is that really what's happening? Like, white people just snatching up black babies. I know that it's not like
literally
like that, but overall, like the perception of it. And so that's really kind of how I always heard it.
You got to talk about, because even as I was perusing on this American Adoptions website.com, there are parts that kind of gave me pause, but and let's just be frank, they were saying that it really, quite frankly, can be easier for white parents to get black children, especially if you're interested in getting black children. Now, you were adopted at a young age, 2 weeks old, right, practically after birth, but especially talk about children that have been in foster care for a bit, right, that might even be older, let alone double digits, right, 10, 11, 12, and be black children, it's much more difficult to adopt those children than it is to adopt, you know, a brand new white baby, right? And so, especially for LGBT couples or couples that might be single parents, it's much easier, right? And I think, it's easier to get you a black to get you a black child for whatever reason.
Well, I've heard, and I don't know if these are rumors or not, I've heard that it's easier, it's swifter, and it's less costly for the family.
Yeah, because you can do private adoptions or you can do public. And for people who do private adoptions, it's much less costly. There's probably people turn a blind eye, right? So we can pick up, pack up our apartment,
yeah,
pretend to live in a different city, and the social worker would never tell anybody. Because
it's similar to international adoptions as well, where I've heard this idea that if you adopt internationally as an American,
certain country,
again,
yeah,
they take away certain rights from the birth mothers there in other countries that they don't in the United States. I've heard, so again, like Sandra Bullock, Angelina Jolie, Meg Ryan, all of them have international and transracial adopted, yeah, kids. And I just wonder, celebrities who have millions upon millions, why did they go that route?
Yeah.
So I'm always curious as to, and to me, I can't help but think it's some kind of fetish, yeah, fetishized fascination with, one, kids that are not the same race as them, but also live and are international children. Yeah, because yeah, Meg Ryan, yeah, has an Asian, yeah, baby. Or a child now.
Yeah.
Sandra Bullock has Leo, the little black boy. Yeah. And then Angelina has her, like, Rainbow Coalition, which she basically copied off of Josephine Baker, yeah, who did it way before her.
Yeah.
And did it better, mind, yeah, you. But, you know, because, you know, but, yeah, so I've
all,
heard
all
those
say
things.
That those things
so,
can begin to complicate.
Complicate,
you know,
even further.
About, yeah, discussions about, like, mm-hmm, you know, like, you do have to figure, like, okay. Yeah, so that
yeah,
just, I mean, that just has a whole nother layer. Yes, okay, so anyway, we said Angelina Jolie.
Yes.
Who else do you all have? Do you want me to go down my list?
Well, I said Sandra Bullock, yeah, Meg Ryan.
Okay, yeah.
I know about those celebrities.
So those are people who have adopted. We've named people who've adopted.
Yes.
What about celebrities who have been adopted themselves? And I was surprised.
Yeah,
I was really surprised
by
this list.
I don't know. I really don't know.
So Maya Angelou.
Oh, really?
Adopted,
oh,
yes.
Really?
And keep in mind that some of these would be people, huh, for example, Malcolm X is on this list. Because
his
again,
parents.
His stepfather was adopted. Yeah. He, you know, he was the birth mother. So some of these are where, and again, that's a form of adoption too, where a stepfather takes over. So we have Maya Angelou. We have Eric Clapton. I love Eric Clapton.
Oh, wow.
Yes,
wow.
He's singing.
I didn't know that.
Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton
okay,
adopted?
Yes. I think that, again, a situation of a stepfather adopting.
Oh, okay. Okay, okay. Yes, yes,
John
yes.
Lennon.
Okay.
Nelson Mandela.
Oh, wow.
Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, wow.
Was adopted. Edgar Allan Poe was adopted. Wow. The list goes on and on. Faith Hill was adopted, the singer, Faith Hill.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There are some people who are birth parents. Roseanne gave up a child for adoption. She was a birth parent. Who else was a birth parent? As I scroll down my list, Joni Mitchell was a birth mother who gave up a child for adoption. You know, David Crosby. Oh, well, of course, he fathered... David Crosby, the singer, he fathered Melissa Etheridge's children, I believe, right, Colson?
Oh.
David Crosby? Yeah, I don't. It, listeners.
Yeah, I'm like that.
Anyway, so...
I didn't know that.
So, yeah, well, I'll tell you what, Morgan, it has been... I mean, we can,
yeah,
do this. We can do this for episodes upon episodes.
Mm.
Before we let you go, what are some misconceptions? Let's talk about some of the good things about adoption. What are some misconceptions? There might be some listeners who are considering adopting a child, whether it be someone that related to, like maybe, you know, my sister's baby is a parent, I need to adopt that, or transracially or even LGBT. What are some misconceptions you want to dispel for folks who might be reluctant to adopt?
That's a great question.
Or some encouragement you might want to give them. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the first thing I would say is that, you know, a lot of times when I was growing up, I would hear people say, and this is honestly even a struggle that my, you know, I hear my family still do, of, you know, those are my kids, and then she's my kid, but she's adopted.
Oh,
and no. So I would, you know, urge if this is something that you're interested in, just know these are your kids.
Change that language. I'll be offended. I'll be packing my bags.
Oh,
like,
very, very.
Yeah.
Very. I was like, yeah. Wait, what do you mean? I'm still a child.
Yeah.
So that would be one.
Did your folks do that, by the way? Did your folks?
You know, that
did they
heard
do it initially and then they stopped? Or?
So it would really depend on the company that we were in. So, you know, when we go out to restaurants and stuff, people would look at us. And if my mom said, this is my daughter, you know, there was always,
wait,
what do you mean? You're white. And so that would be one I would automatically say. You know, another one I would say is that, and this is kind of going back to what you were saying with adopting cross-culturally and internationally and what that really means and how that impacts a person of color, even international born. Especially with the access and the easiness to adopt a black child, it almost in some ways makes me feel like it kind of really made me feel like I was needed saved.
Okay.
So I'm trying to figure out the best way of saying that, but you know, there's this idea when folks see me and they find out that I'm actually biracial. So my birth mom was white, my dad was black, but before they know that, usually a response I hear is, oh, you know what, your family, you know, deadbeat kind of family. Oh, was your family on drugs?
Or size you up as a child to be adopted. Yep. What kind of poor...
What was wrong? Yeah, what was wrong with
your... Thank God for your savior parents to rescue you from whatever pits of whatever you were in.
And this is something that I see a lot when I see families that have kids of different races that... They thank God for them. I'm so glad that you stepped in and you're helping these people. And I know that's also a whole nother story. But really, we don't need freed. You know, we need freed in many ways, but we don't need freed. That's not why this adoption. You know, I look at people and say, my mom, my family was, they were doing well. My family who put me up for adoption. My mom was. In college, it had nothing to do with that. That wasn't the situation that happened. But it's always an assumption that the stereotypes along with black parents in America, that's why you were put in the situation.
Thank you for that. A great point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be another misconception. And, you know, I would really just think about going back to that point when you're looking into this adoption process and you're thinking about adopting a child of color or international. Really think about maybe why you're doing it.
What your motivations are.
So what your motivations are. Do you feel like that child needs a non-person of color in their life? Do you think that I'm white, I'm privileged, I can offer better resources, which is absolutely true in many cases, but is that necessarily the best interest of that child? Those are just some things I would consider, but I would really encourage people to even talk to children who are black and who are maybe international, who have been adopted before maybe making that decision. That would be something, and that's something I was telling a lot of people when I was growing up, talk to us.
Yeah.
Don't make an assumption on, your life must be great because you got this opportunity. And so, you know, talk to us. Really, really ask more questions and ask the good and the bad.
Yeah.
So those are just some of the tips I would. Yeah, would
I'll tell you what, Morgan. We number one appreciate your honesty.
Yes.
Child. We appreciate your candidness. We appreciate your sharing your life story. When you write that book, child, I'll be first in line to get to buy your book. But it really has. You know, for National Adoption Month, we would like to have difficult but also fun conversations here on Strange Fruit. And so you really have provided a lot of insight, a lot of knowledge to the two of us, to our thousands of listeners as well. I didn't get to mention that you are the statewide SART coordinator for the Indiana Coalition to End Sexual Assault.
Yeah.
So in your personal life, you do work around sexual assault, human trafficking. So we'll have to have you back on to talk about that.
Yeah, because that's some justice-needed work. Great, it's great, awesome work. Yeah.
But if listeners have questions, follow-up stuff, can they send us emails? We bring
absolutely.
You back?
Absolutely.
Talk to you some more?
Absolutely. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I thank you all for having me.
All right.
Thanks so much,
Did you have
Morgan.
A good time today?
I had a great time.
All right. Well, Morgan, say goodbye.
Bye, guys. Thanks so much.
Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our editor is Laura Ellis. Our engineer is Kojin Toshiro.
For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.
On the newest episode of Five Things, it's Samuel Penn, a.k.a. Gilda Wabbit, the opera-singing drag queen from Kentucky.
I really have this vision for myself as this very glamorous 50s and 60s showgirl-inspired cartoon character. So I sort of want to look like Betty Rubble if she were a real woman, but in, like, a gown.
Five Things, available now wherever you get your podcasts.